time of year, of course, where in all your courses there's this frantic dash to the end. If this is a good time during the year where if there's something you don't understand, raise your hand and ask about it, because it may get forgotten in the great sweep of an effort to get through the kind of mandatory curriculum. We had started to talk about Gonzales versus Carhart, which is the last of the Supreme Court's abortion decisions, or to put it another way, the most recent of the Supreme Court's abortion decisions. I'm going to start with a question that has nothing to do with the substance of this, well, it has something to do with the substance of this statute, but it has nothing to do with the due process challenge that is asserted here, which is this question. This is a federal statute, not a state law, a federal statute. What power does Congress have that could justify the enactment of this ban on the practice of what is called a partial birth abortion?
Commerce,
because that's always the answer. In fact, in the statute, which I will read this part of it to you, it says, any physician who, in or affecting interstate or foreign commerce, knowingly performs a partial birth abortion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it applies only to physicians who, in or affecting interstate or foreign commerce, perform a partial birth abortion. Does that cover all abortions, most abortions, a few abortions, the ones performed on moving trains between two states? What does it cover? What do you think? Is enforcement of this statute against a particular physician going to be difficult because of the fact that the government would have to prove that the particular abortion that was performed was one that affected interstate or foreign commerce? What category of case is this, of our three Commerce Clause categories?
Category three.
Category three, also almost always the answer. Whenever there's a dispute, anyway, about whether Congress has the power, you can pretty much guess that it's a Category 3 case. So in Category 3, a critical question is whether the statute regulates an economic or a non-economic activity, because that determines whether the standard is more or less deferential. So is the activity regulated non-economic or economic in nature? It's economic. The physician's decision whether to perform a what we'll call a D&X procedure as compared to a D&E procedure, is that decision made as an economic decision?
I mean, if he's getting paid for it.
Well, is the fact that he's getting paid to perform the abortion, if he is, which he may or may not be, if he is, does that make the activity that Congress is regulating, which is the medical decision of how to perform this surgery, any reason to believe that doctors want to perform D&Xs as opposed to D&Es because they get paid more? What's the basis on which the decision is made as to which procedure is going to be used? What would be the
health of the mother?
So is that an economic decision? I mean, that's really the problem here, right? So if it's a non-economic decision, then we're in Lopez territory, and we do have a jurisdictional element. So this case is different from all of the other cases that we looked at under the Lopez line, because it does have this provision about in or affecting interstate or foreign commerce. I have posted on the website two versions of this statute for anyone who's interested in looking at it more extensively, both the limited provisions of it that we're looking at in the context of Gonzales and the entire statute, as are both posted. Okay, so that's just a little subsidiary issue. Do you think members of Congress who voted for this statute care whether it's ever applied to anyone? This is a political question and not a legal question. Do they care whether any doctor is ever prosecuted under the terms of this statute?
No, they're just making a statement.
They're making a statement. I think that that's right. I think that's right. The question of whether the whether the requirement is ever satisfied that the abortion be in or affecting interstate or foreign commerce is probably much less important than the statement that's made by the enactment of the statute. That's probably right. But nevertheless, that's what the statute says, and that's how it's tied to Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. Okay, at the end of last class, I asked a question about the issue of whether the federal statute contained the kind of exceptions that the court suggested would be necessary when they struck down the Nebraska statute in Stenberg in 2000. I'm going to read you some more text from this statute so you can answer that question quite specifically. It says, under the statute, this subsection does not apply to a partial birth abortion that is necessary to save the life of a mother whose life is endangered by a physical disorder, physical illness, or physical injury, including a life-endangering physical condition caused by or arising from the pregnancy itself. So what kind of exception does the statute have, given that that's its text? Does it have a life and health exception?
Just a life
exception. That's right. Congress corrected the deficiency that it was required to include a life exception, but it did not include a health exception. And basically, Gonzalez versus Carhart is a case about whether that failure means that the court has to strike down the statute. That's really the sort of the simple version of the question before the court. Is the absence of a health exception enough to invalidate the statute? What's the answer to that question? What's the answer to that basic question? Is the absence of a health exception enough to invalidate the statute?
No.
No, kind of categorically, or no with some qualifications? What sort of striking down does this statute, what sort of upholding does this, does the court in this case engage in? What, at what level is the statute upheld?
Well, don't they defer to Congress's finding that the procedure would never need to?
Well, that's not really the question I asked, but that's another question that is necessary to ask, whether they do or do not completely defer to Congress's findings. There are some problems with Congress's findings. What are the problems? What do you get out of the main opinion and also Justice Ginsburg's dissenting opinion? What's wrong with what Congress found as a general matter?
I mean, so that there's few times that the exception is even needed, but Justice Ginsburg says that the reason why the exceptions are there is for these minor situations.
Okay, but that's really about this undue burden test. There's a kind of a bigger problem that faces the court in signing on to what Congress found. And the bigger problem is they don't want to, the Supreme Court, I'm going to just put this in non-technical terms. They don't want to look stupid. And therefore, they are very cautious about deferring to the findings that Congress made. Why is that? What's wrong with Congress's findings?
It's not a medical consensus. That's actually true.
Okay, that's, so they claim there's a medical consensus, and there isn't one. That's one problem. Indeed, the court itself at one point describes, the majority, not the dissent, describes the findings that lie at the heart of this federal statute as some of the findings, they say, on the top of 462 are incorrect. Some of the findings are incorrect. Some of the medical findings are incorrect. Now, that may not seem like a particularly loaded statement, but for the Supreme Court to be saying that Congress relied on findings which are factually incorrect, not might be incorrect, but are incorrect, is a big deal. And so the Supreme Court does not want to sign on to findings, defer to findings, that are factually incorrect. So they're very careful about what they tell us they are doing in the context of this particular case. And indeed, they say talking about this that they are relying not on Congress's findings, but the general uncertainty over whether the barred procedure is ever necessary. So it's the uncertainty, not Congress's conclusion that it's never necessary, that the court is going to rely on. So they kind of change it up. They don't rely on the findings. And because of the limited way in which they're relying on what Congress did, something very important happens here. And this gets back to the question I started with, which is in what way, what specific way, and you can keep looking at that same paragraph or that same part of the decision, the last couple of, the last piece of it on 462, in what way does the court uphold this statute?
As applied challenge.
They uphold it as applied? In what way do they uphold the statute? There are two kinds of constitutional challenges. There are facial challenges. If you win in a facial challenge, then it's like tearing up the law, like it doesn't exist. It's been declared invalid. It can't be enforced in any instance. The second possible way to challenge a statute is as applied in a particular case or a particular category of cases. And basically there, you're asking the court to kind of slice off a part of the statute to declare, in essence, that part of the statute is defective and that therefore in some instances it cannot be enforced, but in general it's still constitutional even though it can't be enforced in every case in which the legislature intended to enforce it. So we have facial challenges and as applied challenges. And if a law, if a law is upheld on its face, it does not preclude subsequent as-applied challenges. It's still possible for someone to challenge the law as applied to their specific circumstance. So what did the court do here?
Exactly what you just said. They upheld it on the facial attack, but said in certain discrete cases there may be as-applied challenges later.
Okay. So this law was upheld only in its generalities, but there may be some challenges later on as applied challenges that may be successful. And what's going to be litigated in those later challenges? What do you think would be litigated later on? Suppose you want to challenge it as applied, and you can dream up your ideal client. Who would your ideal as-applied client be, given the nature of this statute? Who do you want to represent? Someone who could argue that as applied to them, the statute is unconstitutional.
Like in a wrongful death suit where the mother died because the doctor refused to perform the partial abortion.
Well, that's not going to help us challenge the statute. But let me ask you some questions. This isn't about a wrongful death action, but I think you're on the right track.
Save the life of if there was a person who needed, for some reason, a partial birth abortion.
Okay, someone whose medical condition required this procedure in order to do what? Needed it in order to do what?
To live.
To live, well, if someone needs it to live, is that banned by the, is that outlawed by the statute?
For the benefit of the health.
Yes, if someone needs this procedure because of a particular health condition, and therefore can argue that the statute as drafted without the health exception is unconstitutional as applied to them, because it would force them to take unnecessary risks with their health, that person is the ideal kind of as applied challenger, because that person essentially is a living example of the fact that Congress got it wrong, and that there are some people as to whom it does make a difference whether you perform a DNX or a DNE. Some people as to whom the doctor being forced to perform a DNE instead of a DNX would result in serious risks to the health of the woman. Okay, so we're going to kind of circle back to this, but I just wanted to flag the fact that there is a very narrow kind of decision in this case, only upholding the statute on its face, but suggesting quite strongly that there may well be subsequent as-applied challenges that could succeed. Now, why does the court do this? If they know that there are going to be subsequent successful as-applied challenges, why do what they've done here? We'll come back to those questions. Let's go back to sort of, I don't want to say the beginning, but the basic issue in the case. In challenging this statute because it lacks a health exception, what standard will the court use to decide whether the absence of a health exception is constitutional or not? What's the basic standard that's going to be used by the court? Undue burden. That's right. That's the Casey standard. The court in this case is affirming that the Casey standard is still the applicable standard that they are prepared to use in examining this statute. So they're not changing the standard. Okay. Well, going back to the undue burden test, how do we apply that test? What do we need to know in order to apply it? Do we need to know why the state has enacted this particular restriction? Is that important to applying the undue burden test? Do we need to know why they're doing this?
We just need to look at the effect on the mother.
Is that all we need to look at? Let's go back and look at the standard. We surely do need to look at the effect on the mother, but is that the only relevant criteria under the undue burden test? Let me read you on 451 the Casey language. A finding of an undue burden is a shorthand for the conclusion that a state regulation has the purpose or effect of placing a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion of a non-viable fetus. So, what do you need to know?
Whether their intent was to place an obstacle.
So does that mean, so that means in order to know intent, what do we have to know about the statute? What does the language say? What do we have to know? We need to know the purpose of the statute. We need to know why Congress did this. Because, you know, only by knowing why can we figure out whether they have an impermissible intent. So it's either, in the Casey language, either an impermissible intent or an impermissible effect that can create an undue burden. And remember, what would be an impermissible purpose? What can't Congress do under Casey? What purposes are unconstitutional? Can the state seek to protect the health of the mother? Is that an acceptable purpose? Can they do that? Sure. Can they seek to persuade the woman to choose childbirth over abortion? Yes. Can they try and hinder the woman from deciding to terminate a pregnancy? No. That, the court says, the state cannot do. A statute with this purpose is invalid because the means chosen by the state to further the interest in potential life must be calculated to inform the woman's free choice, not hinder it. Okay. So we need to know why, and we need to know what effect it has. Well, what about this particular restriction? Why did Congress enact the partial birth abortion ban? What was their objective, as we understand it, from Justice Kennedy's opinion? Why did they do it? Does it protect the woman's health? Any indication that they're doing this because it's healthier for the woman? Is anybody claiming that it has positive health benefits to ban this procedure?
Their intent was to remove one of the methods.
Their intent was to remove one of the methods of abortion, okay? But why? Why did they, why this particular method? Why not remove some other method? Why this one?
Well, the factual findings said it was unethical and immoral, and more akin to killing a baby. So there wasn't much about the health of the mother.
Nothing about the health of the mother. Were they protecting the potential life of the fetus? Is this statute designed to save the fetus? Will this statute reduce abortions?
I don't think so. I think the act expresses respect for the dignity of human life.
Okay, the statute, this is the sort of morality thing, expresses respect for the dignity of human life, okay? Well, is that the same thing as trying to protect the potential life of the fetus?
No, because they're still allowing for abortions. They're just allowing, they're saying that you can only kill the fetus in a certain way.
That's right. This statute is not going to protect the life of the fetus, the potential life of the fetus. There'll still be an abortion. And the only sort of consequence here is what? Who might be endangered by this law? It's not going to save the fetus, but it might
endanger the mother.
Suppose Congress's purpose was to endanger the health of the mother. Would that be acceptable under the undue burden test?
No, that's an undue burden right there.
It's an impermissible purpose, right? Yeah. It's designed to hinder the woman's choice by saying to her, well, you can still choose it, but there may be serious lifelong adverse health consequences you'll suffer, but if you don't mind that risk, go ahead. So that would be an impermissible purpose. So presumably Congress is not saying that. They're saying they're expressing respect for the dignity of human life. Was that on the list of acceptable purposes in Casey? Did that come up in Casey? Or is this kind of a new purpose that we haven't really seen before? What do you think? I mean, Casey dealt with the two purposes that Roe had discussed, right? Is this one of them? Right? It's not one of them. It's neither the health of the mother nor the potential life of the fetus. So something new has been thrown into the mix in this decision. And the question is, well, what else can the state do to express respect for the dignity of human life? So we know why they're doing it. What about the effect of the and obviously Justice Kennedy says that's an acceptable basis for for this law. It's acceptable to enact the law in order to express respect for the dignity of human life. By the way, Justice Kennedy's opinion in some sections which the authors of the casebook have eliminated has very, very detailed descriptions of both abortion methods. If you're interested, you might sort of look at read them and say to yourself, which one seems more barbaric to you? The procedure that Congress banned or the one they permitted? That's for you to judge. In any event, so we now got the question of whether the statute, if it's enacted for a permissible purpose, has an impermissible effect of placing a substantial obstacle in the path of the woman. Now, in Casey, what did we learn about that? When we look at that question, from whose point of view are we supposed to ask that question? Are we supposed to ask the question from the point of view of the woman who has no health problems and doesn't and wouldn't ever need to have the DNX procedure?
From those that it would apply to.
For the woman that it would apply to, or for the women who, for whom it would be the greatest burden? The greatest burden. Remember, the abused spouse, the poor woman who can't afford to travel several times to the abortion provider in order to comply with the waiting period. We're supposed to look at the group of women for whom the statute imposes the greatest obstacle and figure out whether, as to them, it is a substantial burden or not. And in doing that, the court decided the waiting period was not, because its only adverse effect was economic in character, but the spousal notification provision was an undue burden because of the physical risk to the woman's to the woman. So what about here? Who are we going to look at? Which group of women should we be looking at to decide whether the law imposes an undue burden under the Casey analysis? Who should we look at? Whose experience or under this statute should be the group of women who we should be focused on under that?
Low-income women or women with severe health problems.
Well, those aren't the same thing. I mean, low income, does your income change what kind of abortion you can get?
That was a separate group.
There's no indication that this statute has anything to do with whether, you could be very rich and go to a top-notch abortion provider that charges five times as much as anybody else, and they still couldn't perform this procedure, right? I mean, it's not really tied to your income. So what's the other criteria?
Health problems.
So we should be looking at the effect of this law on women who have certain kinds of health conditions that make what the state has done more burdensome for them than it otherwise would be. Is that what Casey teaches us we're supposed to do? So for instance, in her dissenting opinion, again in a part of the case you don't have, Justice Ginsburg talks about the circumstances in which women are put at risk by being denied this procedure. And she says, according to the expert testimony plaintiffs introduced, the safety advantages of what she calls intact DNE, that's the DNX procedure, the banned procedure, are marked for women who with certain medical conditions. For example, uterine scarring, bleeding disorders, heart disease, or compromised immune systems. So among the group of women for whom the denial of this procedure would create problems are women with heart disease, compromised immune systems, bleeding disorders, etc. So would we look at the women with those medical conditions in order to figure out whether the law imposes an undue burden? Is that what we should be doing under Casey? What do you think? Anyone think that's not what we should be doing under Casey? So Casey would steer us towards the women for whom this law would impose the most serious obstacle, and then ask the question as to them, is it a deal breaker? I mean, is it a substantial obstacle or not? Can we do that under this decision? Does the court do that under this decision? Does the court look at the experience of women with certain health problems? For example, some of the women on Justice Ginsburg's list run the risk if the D&E procedure is utilized, of complications which will result in the doctor having to perform a hysterectomy. So she will lose her ability to have any future children if she goes ahead and risks having an abortion limited to the D&E procedure. Does the court look at that woman's problems as they are created by the ban in this case? Who does the court look at? Let's take my hypothetical woman with a particular medical condition means that if she has a late term abortion through the D&E procedure, that it would substantially raise her risks of having to undergo a hysterectomy as a result of the abortion procedure. When would we get to assert her rights? When under this? Absolutely right. An as-applied challenge. That's right. The women who are the most adversely affected by this law, they're not getting considered now because the court says it's enough if for most women it's not going to present that kind of obstacle, or at least if the medical evidence is not clear on the question of how much of an obstacle it creates. The woman with a special medical condition as to whom we know it could involve a substantial risk to her health, her interests have to wait for another day when she faces that decision and someone files an as-applied challenge. So, yes.
So by the time they say, okay, you can do this, because, I mean, if you look at it case by case, you've already had their kid by now.
That's right. I sometimes ask the class, okay, well, what does this mean? When can she bring the challenge? Can she bring the challenge now because her doctor tells her that if in the future she needs an abortion, given her health circumstance, this could create a problem? Or does she have to wait till she's on having an abortion and the doctor says, whoops, I've got to be able to perform a D&X or else there are going to be serious health complications. I better stop what I'm doing and march off to court and try and get permission. When can she challenge the statute? That's exactly right. Now, as it turns out in the law, it's not quite as unfeeling as it might seem, although you could argue that even in the best of circumstances, what the court does here is unfeeling in various regards. But you're allowed to bring a so-called pre-enforcement challenge, and that probably means that someone with a particular health condition that can argue that that they might in the future want to have an abortion, a challenge could be brought on behalf of, let's say, a class of women who have a certain identified health condition that involves danger to their health if they were to be forced to forego the D&X procedure. So it may be that we could have a series of kind of what I'll call mini class actions on behalf of groups of women with certain identified medical conditions who would sue as a class to challenge the statute, the future application of the statute to them. Because the problem here is that you're exactly right. If we have to wait until the woman wants an abortion, it will be too late because of the timeline of litigation. And so it has to occur sort of in advance. Now, whether the court's going to require that some woman actually suffer and then she can sue on behalf of others, we don't really know. But presumably that wouldn't be the case. Presumably there would be a pre-enforcement challenge that would focus on the particular medical circumstances of women with a certain kind of health condition. Now, I don't know whether a whole bunch of women with different health conditions could join together in a single challenge. The court's not clear about that. But surely if you went sort of medical condition by medical condition, or at least groups, women with health, with heart conditions, for example, you might be able to group them together. Women with immune deficiency disorders could be grouped together. What's the advantage from the court's point of view of that kind of a kind of litigation management technique?
Well, I mean, only people standing or people who are affected can sue. It's not like you can sue for political motivations or other reasons.
Okay, only people with the associated health conditions can sue.
Like otherwise, it's just an interest group could sue to challenge the law or something.
Well, that's not how standing works, but I think you're generally right that obviously a ban on abortion, there are many people who would have standing, any woman who could claim that she, and in fact doctors on behalf of their patients. And that's in the abortion cases, I should say that the principal challengers are usually doctors and not their, in addition to their patients. Remember in Griswold versus Connecticut, Estelle Griswold was a doctor and not a woman who or a man who wanted to use contraceptives. And she sued on behalf of her patients who wanted to be prescribed contraceptives. And so it's not unusual that these cases is actually the physician who treats women with a certain medical condition. I mean, the problem in the abortion case is not finding a plaintiff. It's not really finding a plaintiff. And I don't think really the court thinks that they're making it impossible to find an appropriate plaintiff. I don't think that that's really, that's what they do in the cases of separation of church and state. They make it impossible for anybody to sue complaining about those that particular deficiency in some circumstances. But not here. They're not really thinking that a lawsuit couldn't be constructed and we couldn't find an appropriate plaintiff willing to sue. And the same interest groups that would be willing to bring the on-its-face challenge, they're willing to foot the bill for the as-applied challenges as well. So that's, I think, not the issue. What does the court get out of this from a litigation point of view?
They said that in an as-applied challenge, the medical risk can be better quantified and balanced, can be explained better than trying to explain all of these different medical risks in just one big general suit.
Okay, so that's one thing that can happen. The focus of attention will be on the particular medical condition that's implicated in the as-applied challenge and the extent to which a woman with that condition, the extent to which her health is placed at risk by the absence of the ability to perform the DNX, right? That's what's going to happen in these subsequent cases. We're going to look at particular conditions and try and assess the degree of risk, the degree of health risk to a woman in that circumstance to see whether this law operates as an undue burden on the exercise of that group of women to choose to terminate a pregnancy. Well, how risky do you think it's going to have to be? I mean, what's going to happen when we look very carefully at the health risks associated with various medical conditions and their complications? What do you think the standard's going to be? Do you have to show that for women with that health condition, Did you have to prove that at least 50% of them would be likely to suffer permanent adverse health effects as a result of being forced to forego the DNX? 25% of them, 10% of them, do you have to show that it's clear that these health risks will occur? How clear that they'll occur? Is it enough if they might occur? I mean, what's the proof going to have to be like in these as-applied challenges? What do you think? Is there anything you can learn from Casey in terms of what kind of proof is going to be necessary?
Well, I think it's Casey to kind of look and see that they have to see reasonable certainty that something is going to occur. Like, obviously, they've already said that, like, anything that threatens the life is in one category and the health is another, but I think that the court is going to want to see evidence that anything that is reasonably going to threaten, like, the health of the mother, as long as it can be proven on medical certainty, that it would be considered an undue burden to not allow that.
Okay. So we have to prove that there really is a health risk with some medical certainty. Right? And that as to women with in the category who have conditions that creates that health risk, as to them, there's some reasonable possibility that they will actually suffer those adverse health consequences. Okay, well, I think that's a pretty good description of what probably is going to happen here. We don't know exactly, of course, because we haven't seen anything like this. And interestingly, when you look back at Casey, when it came to, you know, the situation of married women who were victims of abuse and who would have to inform their spouses about their pregnancy prior to obtaining an abortion, how much evidence did the court have before it in order to prove that those married women would actually be reasonably likely to suffer adverse consequences? A lot of evidence? Did the court speculate? What about in the case of the 24-hour waiting period? The court said it wasn't an undue burden. How did they know that? Did they know for sure that it wouldn't prevent lots of women from obtaining an abortion because of their economic circumstances? Of being unable to take time off from work as required by this requirement. Did we have that kind of evidence in those cases? Or is this kind of a new burden on the challenger here to more carefully quantify the level of the risk?
I mean, the court does reference findings of fact about the four women getting to abortion side. So, I mean, I don't know if there are
okay, so suppose you're representing a challenger here. What's your litigation burden? What do you need? What do you need in order to have any chance of success? I mean, what kind of witnesses are you going to call at the trial? At
the hearing. Trial, hearing.
Medical testimony.
We need medical experts. Without experts, we're nowhere, right? Because those experts have to testify as to the health conditions that exist and the risks associated with those health conditions if an abortion is performed without the possibility of performing a DNX. So a lot of medical testimony is going to be necessary. You know, what's going to happen if the federal government defending the statute comes in with its experts who testify to the contrary? Oh, no big deal. Not really a serious health risk. What happens if the evidence is in what we call equipoise? In other words, there's an equal amount of evidence on one side as on the other. Who wins? What do you think? You think the statute gets upheld if the woman cannot if her evidence isn't any more weighty than the government's evidence, so that the woman bears the risk in that circumstance unless she can prove in some way that's more effective than the government's proof? Is that what's going to happen here?
It would depend on the test that the court's applying, whether they're giving a presumption of constitutionality or unconstitutionality.
Well, what's going to happen here? Under the undue burden test, is there a presumption of either of those, constitutionality versus unconstitutionality? Can we tell? What is the statute, what does this test presume? If it doesn't presume unconstitutionality, does that mean that it's really not a fundamental right after all, no matter what the court says? Have we stripped it of its fundamental character if there's no presumption of unconstitutionality, even if the court doesn't acknowledge that? These are, of course, a lot of the complicated questions that remain in the wake of Casey, of which there are many, many. Now, why is it that the health exception was attacked by Congress? And why is it that the attack on the health exception was successful before the conservative wing of the court? Why are they reluctant to include a health exception? They said, okay, we'll give you the life exception, but not the health exception. What's the difference between those two? Both were supposed to be required by Roe. Both were supposed to be required by Casey. But now, in this case, it turns out that the health exception, at least on the face of the statute, turns out not to be necessary.
The health exception is way too broad and it's not defined. It's the exception is.
That's right, right? There's a fear, and Justice Kennedy talks about this. He says the health exception, he talks about this at the bottom of 460. The government's interest in protecting the life of the fetus that may become a child cannot be set at naught, in other words, cannot be rendered meaningless, by interpreting Casey's requirement of a health exception so it becomes tantamount to allowing a doctor to choose the abortion method he or she might prefer. A doctor could always testify it's better for the woman's health, and it would undermine Congress's objective in expressing respect for the dignity of human life by requiring perform a D&E, which means insert grasping forceps through the woman's cervix and into the uterus to grab the fetus piece by piece until it has been completely removed. 10 to 15 passes with the forceps, tearing the fetus into pieces required by the statute in order to express respect for the dignity of human life. It's obvious to me why that would be the case. In any event, let's go back to that language because I pointed it to you. Pointed it out to you at the end of the last class, 460 to 461. This crucial paragraph. Yeah.
Yeah, but wouldn't respecting the mother's health, if her health was in such great danger, also be an expression of respect for the dignity of the
mother? Not in Congress's view. In Congress's view, I mean, look at it. The fetus is more important than the woman. I mean, am I wrong to say that?
No.
I'm not surprised you would agree with me, but I'm sure not everyone agrees with that statement. But it is true that this is designed to protect the dignity of human life, not in general, but the human life that Congress believes exists in the fetus, and not the human life that exists in the mother, right? I mean,
right.
This is
yeah.
a trade-off. We talked about this last time. These cases balance competing interests. And these particular interests are in conflict with each other, inevitably in conflict with each other. So the court is trying to figure out some technique for figuring out under what circumstance The woman's interests predominate, and in what circumstances the state is allowed to protect the interests of the fetus at the expense of the woman. That's what the cases are all about. That's what Roe was all about. That's what Casey is all about. That's what all these cases are all about. What? How does that balance going to be struck?
But Ginsburg's dissent, her statement about the doctors failing to provide information to the women, and that was like one of the primary reasons, the opinion.
Well, that's right.
And
this is not an informed consent requirement.
Right.
This statute is not about the woman's, the Congress doesn't even claim it is, right? It's not an informed consent requirement. It doesn't require that the woman have both procedures described and then she gets to choose which one. It outlaws one. So it doesn't matter how much knowledge she has. It outlaws one. It's not an informed consent requirement. It's not designed to either inform the woman or to protect her health. It's not designed to protect the potential life of the fetus. It's designed, as Justice Kennedy says, as the Congress says, to express respect for the dignity of human life, or respect for the dignity of the fetus, I mean, however you want to describe this. Okay, so let's look at that paragraph, because I think a lot of important things rest in that language. So if under this language, particularly the part that has to do with on 461, suppose a statute does not impose an undue burden. The court finds, as they did for many of the statutes in case, in the parts of the statute in Casey, that the statute does not impose an undue burden. What happens next under the analysis as described in that paragraph?
They do a rational basis test.
So it's not over once we decide whether the law does or does not impose an undue burden. It's not over. There's still going to be a test applied. That's what the court says. They say in talking about this, where it has a rational basis to act, talking about the government, and it does not impose an undue burden, the state may use its regulatory power to bar certain procedures and substitute others, all in furtherance of its legitimate interests, not compelling, in regulating the medical profession in order to promote the respect for life, including life of the unborn. So if the law does not impose an undue burden, then it will be upheld, as the court decides this one doesn't, it will be upheld on the basis of minimum scrutiny, rational basis review. So they're not saying this is a compelling interest. They're saying that morality-based regulations such as this one satisfy the rational basis test because they've already concluded the law doesn't impose an undue burden, and that means, from the court's point of view, that the rational basis test is applied. What would happen if the law imposed an undue burden? We came out the other way. What would happen now? Strict scrutiny. That's right. Suppose it. Suppose take the Roe statute. Texas reenacts an absolute ban on abortions, including all second trimester abortions prior to viability, and the court would therefore decide that the law imposed an undue burden, and Texas would only get to enact such a statute if it satisfied strict scrutiny. Let's take the exact provisions of Roe. Suppose a state passed a law saying abortion is banned after the point of viability, and someone challenged that as imposing an undue burden on the abortion decision. So post-viability abortions are banned. It's challenged by someone who says this law imposes an undue burden on my exercise of the right to choose whether to terminate my pregnancy. Is that claim correct? Does the law impose an undue burden?
In Randolph, D.C., the time frame would be important in that.
Is the time frame important? This is an absolute bar on abortion.
So you say your trimester.
But it's an absolute bar on late abortions post viability? Does it impose an undue burden? All absolute bars, by definition, impose an undue burden. There's no more. There's nothing more burdensome than saying it's illegal to do it. That's the ultimate burden. You've absolutely prohibited it. So it does impose an undue burden. So why is it constitutional?
It passes strict scrutiny.
That's Roe. It's exactly the same result as in Roe. The post-viability abortion was, the state was permitted to ban post-viability abortions because of the court's conclusion that that ban satisfied strict scrutiny because of the state's compelling interest at that point in banning abortion and the fact that these were necessary means to accomplish that objective. So here too, if you have something that imposes an undue burden, it doesn't absolutely mean that the state can't do it. It only means that in order to do it, they have to satisfy the strict scrutiny test. So if that's true, if what the court says here that, well, depends on what test we're going to use, if it's not an undue burden, we're using rationality, but presumably if it is, we're using the stricter test, strict scrutiny, what does that mean the undue burden standard is doing? This is the question we started with.
It's kind of a sorting mechanism.
It's kind of a sorting mechanism. Now, not everyone would necessarily agree with this. This is my best expert opinion after years of looking at these cases over and over and over again, every single word in them, trying to figure out what this is doing in the analysis, what role it is playing. I think it does perform a sorting mechanism, and for this purpose, I have put on the website, I don't know how many people have looked at these, a couple of charts. One of them is substantive due process without the undue burden analysis, just the straight substantive due process analysis. The world is divided into fundamental rights and non-fundamental rights. Fundamental rights can be enumerated or non-enumerated. The ones that we're looking at now obviously are non-enumerated. If you convince the court that the right at issue is fundamental, then you go down to here, and it can only be upheld if the government can satisfy strict scrutiny review. By contrast, if the court decides that the right at issue is non-fundamental, then the government, then you have the burden of showing that the law doesn't have a rational basis, minimum scrutiny review. So we have a sorting mechanism that operates depending on the nature of the right. Fundamental versus non-fundamental controls the standard of review and largely controls whether the challenger wins or loses. So then what I've done is insert into this analysis, which is kind of standard analysis, the two-track system, the undue burden piece of it. So the undue burden piece of it seems to operate when we're dealing with a non-enumerated fundamental personal liberty, such as privacy rights, Griswold, etc. Once you decide it's fundamental, then you ask the subsequent question, if the infringement on the fundamental right is less than absolute, the law may be subjected to an undue burden analysis. Griswold, let's take Griswold. Is the undue burden analysis useful in Griswold? Useful there? How much of a burden was the Connecticut law on the right to use contraceptives?
I don't think it matters because it's fundamental.
That's the only circumstance in which it does matter. If the right is non-fundamental, we don't need undue burdens because we're already using rational basis because of the character of the right. Griswold involved an unenumerated fundamental right. Do we use undue burden in Griswold now?
Well, there's a complete bar on all
kinds of complete ban! So it's automatically an undue burden. It's not even worth discussing. We go right to strict scrutiny. What if the Connecticut statute was less than a complete ban on contraceptive use? What if it imposed some modest obstacles on contraceptive use? What if it said, you can't buy a contraceptive without a doctor's prescription? So you can't go into the drugstore and just buy them at the checkout counter, buy condoms at the checkout counter. They have to be prescribed. Undue burden or not undue burden?
Well,
Would you use that analysis to figure out whether you're in a, whether the state has to satisfy strict scrutiny? Could you use it? Could use it. Well, is that an undue burden requiring a doctor's prescription?
I probably would say it wasn't.
Might say it wasn't. Is there an argument that it is?
Yeah. Not all people might not have health insurance or physicians.
Well, okay. We could look at the group who don't have health insurance and physician care. You know, would it be an argument that sometimes the decision to use contraceptives is made at the spur of the moment, and maybe someone doesn't have time to go to the doctor's office and get a prescription? Is that, does that make it an undue burden as a practical matter, that it's not very practical? You know, that would be the kind of discussion there'd be, and depending on the answer, undue burden, not undue burden, what if the state passed a law saying, well, you can use contraceptives, you can buy them any of the day of the week, but Sunday. On Sunday, you can't buy them or use them. Is that an undue burden? 6 out of 7 days. In any event, you know, we could use it in any case where, you know, it's less than a total ban. Most intrusions on fundamental rights are total intrusions. They don't give you part of the right versus, you know, all of the right. I mean, abortion is a fairly unusual circumstance that doesn't apply in very many other circumstances. Many other cases, we're talking about absolute bans, like in Griswold. I once gave a question, there's a federal ban on cloning. It's an absolute ban. There's no exceptions any way, shape, or means. If it's a fundamental right, then strict scrutiny. So in this analysis, the undue burden test operates as the second sorting mechanism in due process analysis. We sorted once between fundamental rights and non-fundamental rights, and now we're sorting a second time between undue burdens and less than undue burdens. And once again, there's another chance to choose the standard of review. Rational basis, if it's not an undue burden, strict scrutiny, if it is an undue burden. So I think that's the best. It may not be perfect, but it's the best explanation, I think, of the available explanations for what role this is playing in the analysis. Okay. Now, we now have a group of cases that follow the abortion cases that deal with the marriage and family relationship. And they really, are relatives, I'll say, of Griswold to a certain extent, because they start with the marital relationship and whether there's a fundamental right to marry, and then they deal with parentage issues, the ability to raise your child in the way that you choose. They deal with issues of whether someone has the right to be considered a parent in the case of the Michael H. versus Gerald D. case. So they involve various kinds of sort of family relationship rights that arguably also fall within the zone of privacy. And we're going to take a look at a couple of these in talking about this. And let's take a look at Zablocki versus Redhale on 464, which is the ban on deadbeat dads marrying. So in this particular case, there was a Wisconsin law that prevented fathers who had not satisfied their support obligations, their obligation to financially support minor children, when they applied for a marriage license, as Mr. Redhale did, he was turned down because he had not fully paid his court-ordered support. And he challenged this statute. So what kind of a right does the court say he has? Or what kind of right has he been denied? What's the characteristics of this right under the due process clause?
They say that the right to marry is part of the fundamental right of privacy.
Okay, part of the right of privacy. That's right, we're building that zone of privacy back up again. It took some hits in the more recent abortion cases, but now it turns out it has some other dimensions to it. And why would marriage be within the purview of this fundamental right of privacy or liberty, however you want to describe it, the fundamental piece of the due process protections for personal rights? Why the right to marry? Do we know why the court thinks it's within the within the zone of privacy? Long been recognized, okay, and long recognition, where does that come from as a consideration? Why do you know that it matters that it's long been recognized? What case taught us that? Griswold, remember the right of the married couple to marital privacy, to privacy and the intimacy of their relationship was something that had been recognized for a very long time through history and was supported by sort of American traditions in terms of the sanctity of marriage, the state encouraging the marital relationship. So here too, we're talking about marriage, and the court basically reaches the same conclusion by looking at history and tradition. In Moore versus City of East Cleveland, the court deals with a zoning ordinance. And the zoning ordinance defines a single, the zoning ordinance creates a zone in which you have to be a single family in order to live within that zone. So this particular family argued that they should be considered a single family under the East Cleveland zoning ordinance, but they consisted of a grandmother and her two grandsons who were first cousins and not brothers. So they were each the child of one of her children, but not both the children of the same one of her children. So under the way the ordinance worked, as crazy as this may sound, if she had been raising her two grandsons who were brothers, they would have been considered a single family. But because she was raising her two grandsons and they were first cousins and not brothers, they were not considered to be a single family under the East Cleveland zoning ordinance. And she challenged the constitutionality of the zoning ordinance, arguing that she had a right to form a family relationship, a privacy right, a fundamental privacy right, protected by the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. And the court agreed with her. Why? Why is the right she asserts considered to be fundamental, the right to live together with her two grandsons?
Important, the sanctity of family outweighs.
Okay, they say the institution of the family, you're right, is deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. So one of the ways we know whether a right is fundamental is we examine history and tradition. Well, is this the same history and tradition as we saw in Griswold? What does the government argue in response to this history and tradition argument? What do they say about history and tradition? What kind of families do history and tradition recognize? Nuclear family. Mom, dad, and the kids. Just the nuclear family is, the Leave It to Beaver family. Did anyone watch that ever? Father Knows Best, all those great old TV families that, involve mom, dad, and the kids. Ozzie and Harriet, the Nelsons, my personal favorite from the old family shows. I had a crush on Ricky Nelson, I'll have to confess. in any event. And then he died tragically in the plane crash. Anyway, so So, the traditional, the nuclear family, the court says, the city says, is the traditional family. And only that family is protected by history and tradition. And what does the Supreme Court say in response? What's their response to that?
They say ours is by no means a tradition limited to respect for the bonds uniting the members of the nuclear family. The traditions of uncles, aunts, cousins, and especially grandparents sharing a household has roots equally deserving of constitutional recognition.
That's right. They say our tradition is broader than just the nuclear family. It also recognizes the extended family and particularly grandparents raising their grandchildren. And so the court says history and tradition is broad enough to incorporate the kind of family that Mrs. Moore and her grandchildren were an example of. And so the fundamental right of sort of a family relationships to live together as a family extended to this family, even though they might not have been the traditional mom, dad, and the kids kind of family. So then the court decides Michael H. versus Gerald D. Now today, if this were today, these folks would have their own reality show. Because when you read through the Supreme Court opinion describing the complications of the relationship between Carol D., the mother, and Gerald D., her husband, and Michael H., the interloper into the relationship, you'll see that does have all of the soap opera characteristics of a good reality show. But in this particular case, California has a statute which presumes almost conclusively that if a woman has a child while she is married, that her husband is the father of her child. In this particular case, Michael H. challenges that, and he argues that medical evidence proves virtually conclusively, 98.07% probability based on a blood test, that he is the child's biological father, and that he should be able to have rights, if not to custody, at least to visitation. He should be recognized as a father, and California law prevents him from doing so. And he argues he has a fundamental right to establish a relationship with his biological child. And the state argues, of course, that he doesn't. And the court agrees with the state of California. And next time we'll start with the question of why. Now, on Friday, we have a long class again starting at 9:30. So we will be doing not just the two cases in the next assignment, Bowers and Lawrence, which kind of complete the unit. They're at least for my purposes, the two cases are not very long, and we can complete our due process examination, and then we'll also go on to the next assignment. I hope to split the time about 50-50 within class, which begins our unit on the Equal Protection Clause. So that'll give us about 4.5 classes on equal protection. Reminds me of the old days when they play this name that tune. How many notes can you name that tune in? So the question for me is, how many classes can I teach equal protection in? Okay, see you on Friday.